You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in Caminito del Rey.
Hello and welcome to Granada. This evening I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And Fran Reyes.
Hello Lionel, hello Daniel.
Fran, this is your hometown.
Yes, this is my hometown and this is and one of my favorite bars. 100 meters away from my former apartment, a pretty nice tapas bar by the name of Tocateja, where I am remembering that I took some Canadian listeners from the cycling podcast back in May for a dinner. Yes.
Really?
Yeah, one friend of mine, former journalist, was coming here for a bike ride with his friends, and I took them all here for dinner.
Wow.
So I am offering you the same treat, and you will see how good it is.
Well,
we're going to eat eggs.
The speciality features fried eggs, and Daniel doesn't eat eggs, unfortunately.
Well, you are in egg country, Daniel. You are in egg country, I'm sorry.
I think eating eggs is sinister, inherently sinister. Anyway, Fran, Granada is not your native city, is it? You're from Almería, aren't you?
Yes, I am from a village in Almería by the name of Berja, but Granada is the place where I moved to live 4 years ago when I was stranded, unemployed, and I decided I wanted
to
restart.
Are you not still stranded and unemployed?
Well, it was easy to take me on board, so you can assume yes.
Oh, dear. Well, I've been to Granada before. It's a charming town, city. I mean, what struck me was just how kind of sprawling it is here. Sort of butts right up to the mountains of the Sierra Nevada behind us. We can't see them here because we're in a little street, but it's a big range of mountains behind us.
Is this not your spiritual Spanish home as well? Because isn't there a connection between Watford Football Club?
There is.
Granada.
There
club.
Is. We've gone from Malaga, where Javier Gracia, the coach of Watford, used to be coach of Malaga. I actually paid homage to the stadium last night on our way back from recording the podcast. I drove by Malaga's stadium and took a photo. Tomorrow morning, I may even go to the stadium here in Granada. The family that own Watford used to own Granada also. And, they're kind of... I'd say the Pozzo family are almost the Patrick Lefevre of football club owners. Fingers in so many pies. Never quite get to the bottom of what's going on there.
99.99999% of tourists who come to Granada make a beeline for the Alhambra. Lionel goes to Granada's football stadium. Fran.
Well, I've been there before, so I've not been to the football stadium. So you know,
another monument worth visiting.
The twin monuments of the city. I'm ticking them off one by one.
Fran, for people who don't know, what is the Alhambra?
Well, the Alhambra is a former Moor castle. It was indeed the last defensive fort left back when the Muslims ruled in Spain. The king and queen from Castilla and Aragon allied together to take the Moors out of the peninsula, of the Iberian Peninsula. And the last bit of Rome that the Muslims had left was Granada and specifically the Alhambra.
And then they founded a brewery, is that right?
Yeah, for sure. It was immediately after.
Alhambra, of course, being the name given now to... the local tipple, the favorite beer of Granada these days.
Exactly. Wide range of beers, all of them pretty tasty and pretty distinctive. I'm glad that Lionel got to enjoy the red one and the green one.
Indeed, yes. Well, I'm impressed, Fran. I was starting to think you didn't know anything about Spain. Because whenever I've asked you, what's this place famous for? You always give me a blank look, but you, to be fair, you do live here, so I'd expect you to know a little bit about the Alhambra. Anyway, it was stage four of the Vuelta today, wasn't it? And it was a biggie. It was from Vélez Málaga to Alfacar Sierra de la Alfaguara. a national park where Fran went on a third date with his girlfriend. That's the breaking news. There's not some kind of monument or plaque up to say, you know, Fran Reyes, you know,
there will be
an unsuspecting senorita on the slopes, on the arid slopes of the Sierra de
La Alfaguara.
The thing that was notable about it, it was beautiful up there. I mean, it was very exposed. And then, as you said on last night's podcast, Fran, suddenly it was all trees and a bit of shelter and shade. And I managed to have a lovely siesta this afternoon because there was absolutely no connectivity to the outside world. No mobile signal, no Wi-Fi. So I was able to just switch off for an hour and have a little siesta in the shade. It was the best day of the Vuelta so far.
Which was great because around Lionel, there were a bunch of journalists talking about the stage and there was a big screen with the stage broadcast. But Lionel was sleeping peacefully. And even when I tried to make conversation with him, he told me, "Nah, wake me up when the climb begins."
To be fair, I woke up a bit before that, listeners, and was ever professional. And I've certainly managed to cobble together enough to give this more than adequate tale of the etapa. Stage four, there was a big break today, and it included, once again, Luis Angel Mate of Cofidis, Ben King of Dimension Data, Ben Gastauer of AG2R, Nikita Stelnov of Astana, Pierre Hollande of EF Education First, Lars Boehm of Lotto NL Jumbo, Yella Wallace of Lotto Sudal, and a couple of Spaniards from the wildcard teams, Aritz Bagues of Euskadi Murias and Oscar Cabedo of BH Burgos. Now, they got so far up the road, more than 9-10 minutes at one point. They still had 9 minutes with 50 kilometres to go, and it meant that Ben King was the virtual leader on the road, ahead of Ben Gastauer, and many minutes up on Michał Kwiatkowski, and there was really no concerted chase. So the break started the climb with still 8 minutes in hand. It broke up a bit on the climb. Ben King, Stalnoff and Wallace were away from the others. Pierre Rolland kind of missed the boat, really. Wallace was then dropped, and that left King and Stalnoff to fight it out for the stage. With 3.5 kilometres to go, King knew that his bid for the red jersey was over, but that probably simplified things for him because it was just the stage win that was up for grabs for him, and it came down to a fight between King and Stalnoff. Rolland was closing in fast, but just as he got within touching distance of the leading two, basically the sprint opened, and King wasted no time. He accelerated very hard and won the stage. Dimension Data's first World Tour win of the season. And let's not forget, it's only a month or so ago that Ben King was kind of apologising on social media for causing the crash at the San Sebastian Classic that ruled Mikel Landa out of the Vuelta, and also led to some pretty bad injuries for Egan Bernal. He obviously felt terrible about that, but he was celebrating this evening with the stage victory, not the red jersey though. There was then a secondary race for the GC behind. Team Lotto NL Jumbo really rode extremely well. They looked like kind of Team Sky Light. They had bodies on the front of the GC group. Sepp Kuss, who was so impressive riding in America earlier this month, put in a huge effort. And then Simon Yates made a move and gained, a good chunk of time, 30 seconds plus on everybody that matters. We'll hear a little bit about what that was all about. And so at the finish, well, no change to the red jersey. Michał Kwiatkowski is still in red, but Emmanuel Buchmann of Border Hansgrohe has closed to within 7 seconds of the overall lead. Simon Yates is at 10 seconds, Alejandro Valverde at 12, and Wilco Kelderman at 25. All the other jerseys stay on the same shoulders. So Kwiatkowski is still leading the points competition, but Valverde will wear the green jersey tomorrow. And Luis Angel Mate is still the king of the mountains, having got into that break today. Before we discuss the Vuelta stage in a bit more detail, just an update on the Aqua Blue team, who were racing here this time last year, of course. At the start of the week, they learned that the team was coming to a halt at the end of the season. Well, today, things took an even more dramatic turn for the riders because they learned that they won't even be riding the Tour of Britain, which starts at the weekend. So the riders really have been left high and dry. And as I said in the podcast last night, we had a rider's diary planned from the Tour of Britain with one of the Aqua Blue riders. Well, Clearly, that won't be happening now, but there will be an episode dealing with the collapse of the Aqua Blue team and the circumstances that have led to a lot of riders and staff looking for jobs very late in the season.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. And it's that time of the Grand Tours when we open the nominations for the Pedaleur de Charme for the opening week of the Vuelta. Still a couple of days to keep your eyes out for some charming pedaling. But if you see anyone that's deserving of the award, nominate them on Twitter at @cycling_podcast. Daniel, what did you make of the stage today? And in particular, Simon Yates doing pretty much what Mitchelton Scott said they wouldn't do, which was putting in kind of time gaining efforts in the first week of the race.
Well, Lionel, I spoke to him at the finish and he was almost contrite. He was very down on himself. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. Oh, what a terrible mistake. I went and gained 30 seconds because they have been talking a lot about the fact that he's not going to ride the way he did the Giro, and he did exactly the same thing as he did at Mount Etna. He rode away with a couple of kilometres to go and he couldn't help himself, and I got the sense that he thought what's the pre-watershed version of a bollocking.
Well, a bollocking, obviously.
A bollocking. I almost got the impression that he was expecting a bollocking for doing exactly what his director sportifs had said he shouldn't do, but on the other hand, it was a bit of a wide half volley, wasn't it? It was two. I mean, we drove up there, didn't we? The last 2.5 kilometres, where did he go? About 2.5 kilometres to go.
A bit earlier, like three to four.
Yeah,
you know, the hairpins that are still 7 to 8%, but
okay,
before,
but then
they're
it really flattens out, doesn't it?
Exactly.
And then the road actually descends, and it's quite surprising, given the terrain, given the fact that it is quite an easy finale to that climb. It was quite surprising that he managed to take out as much time as he did, especially with so many contenders in the group behind.
Yeah, but there was a lot of hesitation in the group, as I saw, because Nairo Quintana, Alejandro Valverde, they tried to somehow set a pace or try to just fire back, but they never really put a tempo that would prevent the growth of the gap of Simon Yates. So they practically give them a free ticket to get as much as he could.
But isn't it the case that the Vuelta course is not quite the same as the Giro course, in that really the next opportunity to do anything is on Sunday, La Covatilla. That's a much harder climb, isn't it? And really, two efforts in the first week wouldn't be, you know, it certainly wouldn't be on a par with what Simon Yates did in the Giro. So it's not like he's digging the same trench for himself, is it?
No, I would agree with you, Lionel. And I think, you know, Fran talked about that hesitation. Lotto and El Jumbo had kind of blown all of their matches by that point. I mean, they'd ridden really well. But Sky, we can see, are much, much weaker here at the Vuelta. Kwiatkowski was isolated with about 5 or 6 kilometres to go to the finish. And then Movistar were left with Valverde and Quintana, who are both really pursuing their own objectives in this part of the world. So Quintana thinking very much about Madrid and the general classification. Valverde seems to me, although he said to us the other day, another red jersey is not going to change his life, he seems to me to want to get that red jersey. And he did, I mean, he did attack Kwiatkowski in the finale, and you know, he certainly wasn't, what he definitely wasn't doing was setting a pace for Quintana to reel back Simon Yates and to limit whatever gains Yates was going to make.
Yeah, but I think that in the case of Valverde, one of the main features of Valverde is competitiveness. He likes to compete, and whenever he finds himself with good legs, he is not the one to let the race go away. He will always try to do his best and maybe try to win. In this case, he had a special motivation. In 2 days, we are arriving to Murcia, his home region. So I am sure that he was thrilled to make it into Murcia in the red jersey, because he is that kind of person, you know, that he gets very motivated when he is in front of his home public. But the publicly stated goal of Valverde is to prepare the world in Innsbruck. So at some point, I assume that he will drop himself and lose all the time necessary to be out of contention for the GC, maybe able to help Nairo, Quintana, or Richard Carapaz at any point, but not thinking of winning the race.
Well, I mean, Richard Carapaz is riding himself out of the picture, really, in terms of any kind of GC result, but certainly a potential stage winner later on if things don't work out for Quintana. I mean, Quintana looked pretty okay today. I mean, more than okay today. I mean, he's certainly not conceded anything. He was in that group looking perfectly good. And as we know, you know, when he's trying to get on the podium in a Grand Tour, he generally tends to be better in the third week anyway. But what did we make of Lotto Eno Jumbo, and they had yellow and black jerseys on the front. They also had Simon Yates sort of sat in there like a little interloper, but at first glance it looked like they were all the same team because the jerseys are so similar. But they're clearly, and you know, I don't want to give Richard too much credit here because he's not here, but they clearly are looking at developing a GC type model in the image of Team Sky, aren't they? And at the finish, I spoke to Steven Krauswijk and made that point to him.
We definitely already did a good Tour de France, and we want to continue running like we did there, aggressive. And even maybe we are not yet the best in the race, George and myself. We want to try something from the bottom to make the race definitely a little bit harder than it was. So, that's also good for the morale. The guys are really strong from the beginning of the climb and perfect position for us. So that made it a lot easier for us, and I want to continue like this.
What's the climb actually like? How does it compare to other more famous climbs?
Pretty irregular and steep parts, wind. So it was not a typical climb.
And lastly, Sepp Kuss was very impressive over in America earlier this month. What did you make of his performance today? Really stepped
wonderful
up.
Wonderful job till the end, so as we could see.
Daniel, what did you make of Lotto Eno Jumbo's riding today? Sepp Kuss was impressive for a long, long time, longer than we could have expected, really. We did ask ourselves, how will he fare when he comes back to Europe to race here after doing well in America? And we're trying to weigh up how strong that level of racing in America is. But they did look good, didn't they? Or am I overdoing this just because it was a great appearance, but perhaps the substance wasn't quite there? I don't know how to assess it.
Most importantly, we can debate the sort of physical merits of the performance, how hard it was to do what they did on that climb with the climbers they've got in the race. But I think what was encouraging, heartening and impressive was the ambition they showed. And in a period in professional cycling when we hear journalists and also other riders bemoan the lack of real challenge being laid down, in particular to Team Sky, they've done it at the Tour de France and they're starting to do it here with a rider. I mean, I get the impression that George Bennett is their best hope for a top five finish overall, and to show that much ambition with a rider who has never finished in the top five of a Grand Tour, I think is quite admirable. George Bennett has never broken the top five of Grand Tour. However, by all accounts, he's absolutely flying at the moment. His name is, whenever you're asking any of the favourites at the moment who has impressed them so far in the Vuelta, Bennett's name has come up a lot.
Do you not think that it's a bit like, you know, if you want to get a promotion at work, you kind of do the job and then you get the job? You know, teams have so few opportunities to have a go at this. You know, Team Sky have had a stranglehold on the Grand Tours going back a number of years now. There haven't been that many opportunities for other teams to try something, even just emulating what Team Sky do. I mean, yeah, it's one of the big problems that all the teams have, is that if Team Sky want to set the pace, they'll set the pace just that half turn quicker than anyone else can do. So it's a great opportunity for them to have a go and see how it feels and see whether it works.
Exactly. I want to make the same point. I think this was more of a rehearsal for Lotto and El Jumbo. They have the elements to build a very good mountain train. They are bringing in more firepower with, for example, the likes of Laurence Depluse, all of them young riders who are still growing as a cyclist, who are still growing their physical potential. The sooner they begin to try and do a mountain train, the sooner they will get the perfect one. So I read that into today's stage. Sepp Kuss performed great today, and he is quite an element to take into account for upcoming Grand Tours.
Question today for Dr. Rob Child at Science and Sport is from Paul Hansford. Hi, guys. Fantastic work on the Tour de France podcast. Thanks, Paul. Question for the Science and Sport lab coats. You're not actually wearing a lab coat, Rob, but one thing that I don't see a lot about with nutrition is when the frequency you should be eating your bars and gels. I realize you should take a certain amount of carbs per hour, but when within that hour do you take it? Is it nibbles of the bars throughout the hour or all in one go halfway through the hour? I always feel a little lost with when. Thanks, Paul.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for that question. I haven't got my lab coat on today, but I spent plenty of time in the field trying to address these kind of issues. So that's what I'm going to try and provide now, a little insight into that. So really you should aim to drink every 5 to 10 minutes, if it's possible, during the exercise bout, and then eat every 20 to 30 minutes. So your strategy of nibbling away at things is definitely a good one. Ultimately, your target carbohydrate intake should be about 60 to 80 grams per hour. In terms of what the professionals do, in the longer events, they tend to eat more of the solid foods in the first half of the race, things like fruit, cakes, and energy bars. And then as the pace generally seems to hot up, then they'd use more in the way of gels. And probably for the last hour of riding, they might predominantly use their energy drink and potentially use a caffeine gel as well. It's really difficult to provide specific guidelines on fueling because in part they're so temperature dependent. So for example, in hot weather, you'll drink a lot more. You'll need to drink a lot more to stay hydrated. So a bigger proportion of your total energy will come from carbohydrate drinks, which means that you need less energy from bars and less energy from gels. So there's really no hard and fast rule exactly that will suit all people in all situations. But in general, as I said, we should be aiming for those target intakes of 60 to 80 grams of carbohydrate an hour and eating as frequently as possible.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. If you want to get 25% off everything in the Science in Sport range, go to scienceinsport.com, and then when you check out, enter the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Well, you get 25% off your bill as long as it's not in conjunction with any other offers that they're running. Daniel, there were two races today, really, weren't there? We talked about the GC race and the subtle moves that we've witnessed today. I mean, Vincenzo Nibali well out of it. Several other riders that are already out of the picture, well out of it again today. So we learned a little bit. Emmanuel Buchmann of Border Hansgrohe up to second place overall, only 7 seconds down. What do we know about him, and what can we expect from him in the next week, 2.5 weeks?
Well, Napalm, he's a very demure, shy kind of chap. Slightly uncomfortable in interviews. He's from Ravensburg in the deep south of Germany, very close to the Swiss border, famous for burning witches. Not Emmanuel Buchmann. Ravensburg was one of the first places in Europe where witches were burned en masse in the 15th century. Another place which is very famous for the burning of witches is the Passo del Tonale, which is one of the legendary climbs of the Giro d'Italia, around about the same time, I think, the 16th century. I will endeavour to become an expert on witch burning between now and the end of my time on the Cycling Podcast.
When's that going to be?
I don't know.
You need to let us know when this is, Daniel.
If
Emmanuel Buchmann is ever first to the top of the Passo del Tonale, then wow.
There will be trouble afoot. Buchmann, though, I thought this year that they would send him to the Tour de France, but it was laid out pretty early in the season or early in the winter that he wasn't going to do the Tour and he was going to really target the Vuelta. He has never made as concerted an effort to prepare for a Grand Tour, train for a Grand Tour, and prepare to be the leader at a Grand Tour as he has for this Vuelta. And he's doing very well. I mean, he's a rider that's improved continually over the past couple of years. Go back 2-3 years when, well, he won the German national championships to everyone's surprise, when the team was still NetApp, I think, or was it Bora's first year? Bora Argon 18, and was talked up, touted as a big talent. I think the phrase next Jan Ullrich might have been used by one or two misguided observers. However, he's always looked a little bit one-paced in the mountains, and the kind of guy who could follow would typically be the eighth or ninth or tenth best climber in mountain stages in World Tour races, but could never really attack. I noticed a big difference in him in this year's Dauphiné. Last year he won the best young rider's jersey in the Dauphiné. This year he was really quite aggressive, particularly towards the end of the Dauphiné in the mountains, and that signified to me that he'd made a real step up. And today he was quite bold, wasn't he? And he's second on general classification. And I think, you know, we talked about George Bennett never having finished in the top five of a Grand Tour. Buchmann hasn't either. But he's someone who I could see ending up in sort of fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh place.
Wow. Well, we'll look out for that. I mean, that's some hefty speculation there, but I'll let it go. I did ask the question, to be fair.
The worst things in speculating, you know, witch burning, for example.
I think witch burning is marginally worse than speculating. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. But I mentioned there were sort of two races today, and the race for the stage was, well, it was gripping, wasn't it? Because that break got away. There were some good riders in it. Pierre Olland, probably in terms of reputation and palmarès, a good step above all of the rest. And really, he possibly paid for that on the final climb, because when he hesitated, when the move went, that was it. And we were talking about this in the car on the way down, on our rally drive down from the top on the gravel roads, where you were sort of handbrake turning into the corners, Daniel, or giving the impression that you wanted to. But we were talking on the way down, if Roland had reacted quicker, then it probably all would have come back together again, because no one would want to take Pierre Roland on up towards the finish. So once the gap had opened, King and Stalnoff had all the incentive to push on, and Roland really had missed the boat. And Fran and I both spoke to Roland at the finish, not together. It was just one of those coincidences. So this is what Pierre Roland said at the finish.
Pierre, unlucky, so close. Did you think you were going to catch them?
The problem, man, I start a bit too late, and when it's warm like this, it's really difficult to do really hard effort. And yeah, I stay a long time in 15 seconds, and yeah, but it's like this. Everyone look me for moving, and just Ben King and Astana rider go good enough advantage.
Yeah, so if you had you had made a different tactical choice with that shot, you could maybe have won.
Yeah, for sure, it's possible to win, but it's like this, you know. For sure, everyone in the gap look after me, and with also Mate, he just stay in my wheel for I don't take a point, and yeah, he beat me today.
You've been attacking all week. I mean, you know, maybe the legs just ran out on you at the crucial moment.
No, I don't think it's because I am in the front yesterday and before. It's just before I start, he had already 15 seconds, and 15 seconds in climb like this is hard, and with this weather is also super hard to catch.
And just as you saw them there, they kicked off the sprint, so it was just you just ran out of road.
It's too late. When I almost catch him, but it's too late. I push already all I have.
Try again another day?
Yeah, for sure.
So Roland clearly feeling that, well, he was the marked man in that move, and if he went anywhere, everyone was watching him. EF Education First without a World Tour win this year. Dimension Data, their first World Tour win this year with Ben King, who, as I said earlier, had a pretty harrowing day at the San Sebastian Classic. But, Fran, you said in the car, if you said to me this morning, Ben King will win a Grand Tour stage in his career, you kind of wouldn't have believed that. But it needed this perfect storm of circumstances, didn't it? A big break that got 9 minutes, 10 minutes up the road, and then he had the opportunity to finish it off. And give him credit, he finished it really well.
I think that's a little harsh, Fran. I mean, he's won a stage of the Critérium International in the past, won a stage, if I'm not mistaken, of the Tour of California. He's a solid baroudeur, as the French call them, a breakaway specialist. And I was saying in the car, you were also in the car earlier, did you not hear this? No, it was after we'd kicked you out. I can imagine, I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that, and we've seen this before in the Vuelta, in the same way that Thomas Marcinski won two stages last year, also Granada resident Thomas Marcinski, it wouldn't shock me to see Ben King in a break again, and it wouldn't shock me to see him very relaxed, confident, with nothing to lose, and a threat in another stage.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line of my comment, I mean, I also consider Ben King like a solid World Tour rider and a solid domestic, but I have him in the same box as Sander Armé, for example, that was also in the breakaway. Like, very good powerhouses that were not that, I don't know, canny enough as to get that win off from breakaway. But today, he was perfect from a tactical standpoint. Of course, he had the legs to endorse all these moves, but he made the attack at the moment where it had to be made in order to drop Roland, who was definitely the most dangerous guy in the breakaway. And afterwards, he played perfectly with the nerves of Stalnov, especially after the red jersey was out of his reach. For a moment, he was virtual leader of the race, and he was a bit eager. He pulled a bit too much at some points in order to keep a gap that was big enough as for him to take the red jersey at the finish line. But as soon as the gap decreased, he took a completely different mood. He began speculating, leaving the most of the pulling up to Estelnov, who, after all, even if he had changed surnames during his career, has had quite a short one, playing with his youth.
Talking of surnames, Fran, is Ben King the best rider in professional cycling at the moment whose name means king in their native language? Because you've got Ben King, Ted King's gone, there used to be another Ben King, Leopold Koenig has had a lot of problems the last couple of years.
Jeremy Hua. Is there a Spanish rider called Ray? Anyone?
Yeah, well, we have a Colombian one, Adelmar Reyes. Promising rider, he rode the Vuelta with Manzana Pozzo last year. So at some point, my cousin is going to become big, but I don't know when.
And of course, Fran Reyes, king of podcasting.
There you go. We discuss all the big issues here.
Just to clear that up. To clear that up about Stalnov and his changed surname, Fran, Nikita Stalnov of Astana, well, he used to race under his father's surname and then tested positive when he was quite a young rider. Was he still an under 23?
Yeah, he was known as Nikita Umervekov until age 20. Then he tested positive and came back as Nikita Stalnov. But apparently he told me that his parents divorced. And that was then that he chose to take on the name of his grandfather.
Right.
The surname of his grandfather. Not like he was trying to wash out his name, you know, and his doping record. It was only a family matter.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does confuse the old Google searches, that's for sure. Anyway.
We've had this discussion before. Other cyclists who have changed their surname? Domenico Pozzovivo used to be called Pozzovivo. We've had that before.
Yeah. Anyone else?
There was another one, I think. Anyway, move on.
Let's move on.
That's tomorrow's topic.
Don't forget to listen to our morning show, Kilometer Zero, supported by The Economist. Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings throughout the Vuelta a España.
We launched Kilometer Zero here at the Vuelta on Monday with our first episode, Vuelta Vignettes. Potted history. I mean, you need know nothing more about the Vuelta than what we covered in 33 minutes in that episode.
Did you bleep Manolo Saiz about?
I don't think so.
Cutting people up and
no, I don't think we have a no bleep policy.
Oh, okay.
Although,
Eek.
It's fine, Daniel.
We are visiting his hometown in this Vuelta, you know?
Torre La Vega, yeah.
Torre La Vega. It's the start of the time trial.
He doesn't own a restaurant there anymore, does he?
No, that was a bad business, and he closed it,
apparently. This, for those who don't know, Manolo Saez was the boss of the all-powerful Once team. Now, I don't want to go off too much at a tangent, but wasn't he... He had no background in professional cycling whatsoever when he founded the Once team. He persuaded the Once charity, which is a charity to raise money for blind and partially sighted people in Spain, still going strong, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah, and this was at the end of the 80s, wasn't it? And Manolo Saez was involved in junior cycling or amateur cycling?
He was coach for the Spanish Cycling Federation. He was working on the junior ranks and with some other categories, but mainly with junior cyclists.
And he made himself very quickly, almost the Alex Ferguson of Spanish cycling, didn't he? He
had Dave Spraceford.
Steady, Fran. he created a very strong team very quickly, and well, they won the Vuelta several times, didn't they? With Laurent Jalabert and Alex Zülle, never quite managed to win the Tour de France, but came very close. And were all powerful. They're kind of the super stage race team of that generation at the end of the 90s.
In a huff in 1998 with a parting shot, I've stuck my finger up the Tour de France's bleep.
Oh, live bleeping, brilliant. Yeah, well, that was the Festina Tour, of course, and the Spanish teams all went home in protest at the police intervention when the police were finding drugs in team car boots and that kind of thing. Anyway, the Once team then became the Liberty Seguros team eventually after a fashion, and then that was the team right at the heart of the Operation Puerto scandal, based in Madrid, all centred on a gynecologist basically, called Eufemiano Fuentes, and that was the big doping scandal of 2006. It blew up and it cost Ivan Basso and Jan Ulrich directly and sort of slightly indirectly.
The whole last 25 years in cycling history in the last 3 minutes. Stop
there we are.
Before we get on to USADA and the reasons.
Yeah,
decision.
But we throw in these names. Manolo Saez. Some listeners might be like, well, who's this guy? Why is he relevant? Well, he really was an incredible team director, and then he was at the centre of the biggest doping scandal of the last 15 years.
But he has an under-23 team now. One of the most powerful in Spain, Aldro team. Problem is that the riders don't get kind of used to Manolo Saez training methods, you know, and it has failed to create a professional rider until now. Next year, there will be the first alumni in the UCI ranks, Thiago Antunes, Portuguese rider, who is joining SEC Racing Team.
Yeah.
2019.
Okay, yeah, Antunes, yeah. Making a big name for himself on the under-23 scene. Anyway, Kilometre Zero returns tomorrow with an episode looking back 30 years to Sean Kelly's victory in the Vuelta a España when the race was still held in the spring, of course. It was Sean Kelly's only Grand Tour victory. And this is the story of his win and also of the missing trophy. So listen out for Kilometre Zero tomorrow morning and look out on social media for the artwork from Annette Kelly and Grand Tour Art, a lovely illustration of Sean Kelly to illustrate that episode. Anyway, anything else, Daniel, from today's episode while you tuck in no eggs?
Megalomania. The podcast is now more important than the Welter itself.
Only in our own minds.
Anything else from today's stage?
Well,
can I take the baton? Mikael Kwiatkowski,
yeah,
doing quite well at keeping the red jersey. Looked quite solid throughout the whole climb, even if isolated after David de la Cruz got dropped with 10 kilometers to go, more or less. But I think it was a strong showing, more or less the one we could expect from him in this first week of the Vuelta until he surely fades off because of the efforts of the Tour de France, Tour de Pologne, and the preparation for the upcoming Vuelta in Innsbruck.
I was disappointed in Fabio Aru. He didn't... Well, I feared at one stage that he was going to get dropped by the favourites group and lose quite a lot of time. He was yo-yoing off the back. is not looking particularly great and is someone who really is under quite a lot of pressure and needs a result. He was signed as the emblematic figure of the UAE Emirates team. He's been very much overshadowed by Dan Martin and to a lesser extent Alexander Kristoff. And yeah, the 2015 Welter champion, of course, but didn't really look like a champion in waiting today.
Do you think he was helped back on by the fact that the climb had that easy section before the little ramp up to the finish?
Absolutely, Lionel, yeah.
Talking about Team Sky, though, and De La Cruz, I mean, De La Cruz managed to get back. I mean, he didn't actually lose any time today. I mean, he didn't look great at times, but they don't present the same unified force here, Team Sky, do they, as we've seen at the Giro and at the Tour de France this year. Then they're obviously not going to win the race, but Kwiatkowski is, I mean, he's going to keep that red jersey the next few days, isn't he, and up to the weekend. I mean, the time bonuses cause a bit of a problem perhaps, but they're not necessarily going to fall the way of Valverde, are they? So
no, unless Emmanuel Buchmann or Alejandro Valverde take some time bonuses and some time in the Post-Falcon finish, which is a bit lumpy and can maybe indulge some attack, but
tomorrow, no. I think it's an opportunity for Kwiatkowski and Valverde to win the stage.
No.
With a big climb in the finale.
No, it's not. It's a quite steady climb. I mean, quite steady.
Long.
It's long, but three lanes wide. One where it's very comfortable to stay in the bunch, you know?
Is the descent quite long off that as well to the finish? Yeah,
it's long and rolling.
Right.
You know, it's one descent where in order to make a gap, you have to pedal real fast, you know? And it's quite easy to be on the wheel. So I assume that anyone who tries a move at that climb is going to be reeled in easily by the peloton. And also, the finish line in Roquetas is quite flat.
But, Fran, who's still going to be there? The sprinters aren't going to be there. Viviani's not going to be there. I don't think Sagan will be there. So, you know, who's going to be the fastest man in the group? It could be Kwiatkowski or
Trentin, I'd say. I mean, there are a handful of sprinters here that can cope with climbs, and above all, you know, I feel that this Vuelta is hard to predict because the riders are still under an immense shock because of the heat. All the riders they speak about is the heat, about how it is affecting their bodies. You know, today, for example, I was speaking to Dario Cataldo, a standard rider who is used to training here in Andalusia and was feeling in great shape up until this Vuelta, but during this first four stages, he's just not feeling himself. He can't help but to get dropped in terrain where he would normally be in contention, and he puts it down mainly to the heat. So maybe we can have some surprises. I'm sure that the heaviest sprinters, such as the one you mentioned, Viviani, Sagan, Max Walscheid from Sunweb, they will maybe struggle. But the most suited to the climbs, such as Matteo Trentin, even Giacomo Nizzolo, they will make it to the finish line, and those would be the main favourites tomorrow.
But we're not anticipating much of a shake-up overall until the weekend, probably not until Sunday. So it's all shaking up quite nicely. I mean, I don't want to do the ultimate speculation and say who's looking like who's going to be in contention in the final week. But, I mean, you look at how Simon Yates rode today and think, well, on the one hand, showing a little bit too much, being a little bit too eager, but on the other, he gained some time, but without a huge physical cost, and he doesn't need to be doing that two, three, four times. It's not the same toll that the first 10 days of the Giro took on him. He's looking pretty good for, a tilt at the overall here. Who knows? Well, we will find that out. I won't find that out here. I'll be watching at home on the television because Richard Moore will be here by then doing the important bit. But you two will still be here then. But we'll be back tomorrow to talk about Stage 5. Until then, Daniel, we need to get you fed up with a big plate of eggs. No eggs?
No, I'm already looking at people in this restaurant. Because this restaurant... The eggs are a speciality here, aren't they? Where we're in this restaurant. Yeah, I'm already looking at people slightly at the, you know, side of my eye, kind of wondering what their motives are.
No, but you know, you got just here for free because it's included with the beer we are having. Some grilled pork with fries with a bit of mayonnaise. In case
I know what
you
it is from.
Yeah, but isn't it nice? Isn't it tasty? Isn't it good to have?
Rustic. Anyway.
Rustic indeed. Well, I'm looking forward to getting my fork over there, have a bit of rustic pork. Until tomorrow, Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lionel.
And Fran, thank you.
Thank you.